that mind, several Palestinians lose their lives in a fresh bout of violence carried out by the Israeli military in Nablus and Al-Khalil. The Pentagon confirms for the first time that it's supplying Ukraine with anti-radar missiles to use against Russia in the war. Also coming up, China warned separatist forces in Taiwan not to cross its red lines as both sides engage in military drills of their own around the Taiwan Strait. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour, four Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank. Israeli military killed three Palestinians, including a fighter and member of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade, Ibrahim Nablusi in Nablus. A fourth Palestinian was killed during a protest in Al-Khalil. We have more in this report.
Israeli forces have assassinated Ibrahim Nablusi, a resistance fighter and commander of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Israeli troops raided Nablus early Tuesday and surrounded a building in the old city where Nablusi had barricaded himself in. A gunfight lasted for several hours with Israeli forces even firing anti-tank missiles at the building. 32-year-old Islam Sabouh and 16-year-old teen Hussein Jamal Taha were also killed in the raid. At least 60 Palestinians were wounded, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry.
We have not witnessed such an aggressive raid to Nablus in years. The aim was to assassinate al-Nablusi and any other Palestinian who was assisting him. He refused to surrender and clashed with the soldiers for hours and was finally martyred.
As the raid started, we rushed to the old town, but the soldiers had blocked the neighborhood. They opened fire at us. We tried to evacuate the wounded, including a woman, but they continued shooting at us. Dozens were wounded as a result.
Israeli Prime Minister Yair Lapid has reacted to Nablus operation, saying that the killing of whom he described as terrorist Ibrahim Nablusi was another step in Israel's uncompromising fight against terrorism.
This cell has been worrying Israeli military. They carried out a number of shooting against Israeli soldiers and settlers. That is why the Israeli military wanted to strike them and kill one of its leaders.
A number of West Bank cities, including Ramallah and Al-Khalil, observed commercial strikes as part of a period of mourning and in protest at the killings in Nablus. The regime forces clashed with the protesters in Al-Khalil and shot dead at least one Palestinian.
It has become clear that Israel is targeting any Palestinian who is honored as a real fighter. The regime might succeed in assassinating those fighters like Ibrahim Nablusi, but they would even be remembered as heroes and icons who devoted their lives to fighting Israeli soldiers. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
A group of Iranian rights activists have gathered in the capital Tehran to condemn Israel's recent aggression on the besieged Gaza Strip. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Stop the massacre, chant these angry protesters who converged on the Palestine Square in Tehran to denounce the latest Israeli aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip, which left 46 Palestinians dead, including 16 children.
We gather today en masse to show our solidarity with Palestinians. We also want to raise awareness of the Israeli atrocities against the Palestinian people.
We never cease to support our Palestinian brothers and sisters. Why are the world rights entities keeping mum while Israel continues to kill innocent people in Gaza?
Tensions have escalated between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Friday, when Israel carried out airstrikes on cities across the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, killing dozens of people, including two commanders of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement. The Islamic Jihad's military wing, the Al-Quds Brigades, responded by firing hundreds of rockets towards Israel, putting the Israeli forces on the back foot. Activists here say the Islamic Jihad's show of force has pushed Tel Aviv into calling for a ceasefire, which took effect on Sunday.
In the past, the Israeli attacks on Palestinians would go unanswered. But today, as soon as Israel carries out a strike, the resistance responds immediately with its rockets. So, the era of hit and run is over.
The conflict is the worst outbreak of violence between Israel and Palestinian resistance groups since Operation Sword al-Quds, an 11-day war last May. The UN Security Council has expressed deep concern over the situation in the Gaza Strip during an emergency meeting held on Tuesday to discuss the Israeli aggression on the besieged territory.
While the UN has expressed its concern over the escalating violence against Palestinians, activists here say this is not enough. They called on the international body to stop paying lip service and take action to keep Israel from further violation of security in the occupied Palestinian territories. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Well, the U.S. says it has sent anti-radar missiles to Ukraine to help it target Russia's radar systems in the ongoing war between the two neighbors. The Pentagon says the missiles are the high-speed anti-radiation missile, or HARM, and were included in the $1 billion in additional military aid package for Kiev. There's no mention of the exact number, but it's the first time the Defense Department has revealed sending the previously undisclosed missile to Ukraine. Ukrainian authorities have not publicly acknowledged receiving or using HARMs, but in recent days, some reports have shown the remains of what appear to be the fin of a HARM missile that targeted a Russian position in Ukraine. The U.S. has sent $9.8 billion in military aid to Kiev since the launch of Russia's military offensive there in February. Researcher at Institute for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Mr. Greg Simons, joins us from Uppsala, Sweden. Mr. Simons, welcome to the program. I want to get your perspective and thoughts on this latest news. What is the significance of this latest U.S. arms shipment? And what are the chances of more advanced American arms giving Ukraine any form of tactical advantage against Russia?
Well, I mean, this admission absolutely confirms that Ukraine conflict is nothing about Ukrainian sovereignty. It's about using Ukraine as a proxy against Russia to weaken and contain Russia. The fact that it's sending advanced weaponry as this means that this, what would we say, they're becoming more involved than other previous proxy conflicts. So this is a dangerous escalation. And it should also be taken into account that as Ukraine is one of the most corrupt countries, these kinds of technologies can also be sold abroad, as has been the case with a number of the weapons, advanced weapons supplied to them.
Mr. Simons, military experts believe that Ukraine does not possess the type of aircraft that can use these HARM missiles, and this is giving rise to speculations that NATO might be flying its own aircraft to fire these missiles. How likely do you see NATO's direct, but of course secret, military involvement in the war, and could this be why the U.S. confirmed these missiles only after reports emerged on social media about their remnants being found near a Russian site?
Well, if they do, this would be a very dangerous move on their part, because this removes this proxy aspect and they become directly involved. And if you, because this whole thing has been said that NATO and the US is not directly involved. Of course, you can argue the nuances, but this would take away that nuance. And of course, that brings it to the next level and can potentially widen and deepen this conflict, which is already causing a lot of suffering and destruction.
All right, thanks a lot. Greg Simons joining us from Uppsala. Elsewhere, Britain is mulling contingency plans to deal with possible energy shortages this winter amid tensions between the West and Russia that have led to disruptions in energy markets worldwide. Media reports say Britain is planning scheduled blackouts for industry and households. The government's report predicting worst-case scenario says the UK might be forced to trigger emergency measures to conserve gas for 4 days in January. The government report says the coming winter electricity capacity shortfall could total about a sixth of peak demand. In such a case, the UK will have to approach Europe for pipeline shipments of gas, but the continent is already facing low supply from Russia. Moscow cites technical and financial problems as the reason for reduced gas exports. The West has placed massive sanctions on Russia, particularly its energy industry. Widespread surprise in France as corporate profits hit an all-time record high despite major economic malaise. However, efforts for new taxes on big businesses have already failed in France's new parliament, causing many to predict that social unrest might be around the corner. Romy Mazzotti reports from Paris.
France's top corporations, represented in the nation's CAC 40 stock index, just reported its best quarter in its history. 73 billion euros in profits represents a huge 26% increase from last year. The record comes despite the unrest in Ukraine, once-in-a-generation inflation, energy shortages, near-recession levels of economic growth, and the worst difficulties for the average French household since the 2008 economic crisis.
C'est le système politique et social qui est en cause. C'est
France's political and social system is starting to be called into question by these economic inequalities. How long can our public services function, our pensions be funded, and our workers feel long-term stability if we continue on this trajectory, many wonder.
Pressure is mounting to tax big business. Not only are they obviously benefiting from soaring prices, but tax evasion is widespread. National energy giant Total has already declared 18 billion euros in profits this year, but they haven't paid 1 euro in French taxes in 2 years. However, the new French parliament just rejected a leftist-led bill which would have levied new inflation-related taxes on corporate super profits. It's a major victory for President Emmanuel Macron and an indication of where French politics will be steered in his second term. In June's legislative elections, Macron lost his absolute majority in parliament. Even those aligned with him ideologically have refused to make a formal coalition, but parliament still leans heavily to the right. The all-time record corporate profits are likely to inflame economic-based movements such as the Yellow Vests, with many predicting that this autumn could see explosive social unrest.
The question increasingly is how to appease the social tensions which are being created by inflation, inequalities, and our economic problems. We can live with high inflation, for example, but only if the government compensates the average household with economic help. But will that happen? And will it happen fast enough?
Despite the historic profits and the worries for social turmoil, Macron has vowed to continue with far-right economic austerity measures, which will further roll back the social safety net, increase economic inequality, and cut taxes on the wealthy and corporations. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
China pledges zero tolerance for, quote, separatist activities in Taiwan, and warns that it will take the island by force if necessary. China's Taiwan Affairs Office has issued a white paper laying out economic and military measures with regards to the self-ruled island. That's as both sides engage in military drills and shows of strength. Footage has showed Chinese jets flying while Navy ships patrolling around the island and the strategic Taiwan Strait. The Chinese Army, however, says the drill is focused on blockades and resupplying logistics to refine joint containment and control capabilities. China has carried out a set of naval and air drills near Taiwan since last week. Maneuvers followed a controversial visit by U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to the island. Taiwan has also mobilized its air and land patrols and deployed land-based missile systems. China claims Taiwan has its own territory and has repeatedly warned against the island's growing nexus with the U.S. The Iranian Ministry of Information and Communication says it has received the first data from the Khayyam satellite hours after it was launched into space from a base in Kazakhstan. The ministry says the data was received at the Iranian Space Agency's Mohdash base Khayyam aboard a Russian Soyuz rocket was blasted off from Baikonur Cosmodrome on Tuesday. This is a remote sensing satellite that will send high-quality pictures 4 times a day for use in environmental and agricultural researches and monitoring of water resources. Issa Zadepour, Iranian Minister of Communications and Information Technology, says the launch is the beginning of a strategic cooperation between Tehran and Moscow. In the field of space, Russia also put an Iranian satellite into space in 2005. The latest round of the Vienna talks are to restore the 2015 Iran deal has wrapped up in the Austrian capital, Vienna. However, some issues are yet to be resolved. Iran's negotiating team says it remains steadfast in securing a deal between a deal rather, but insists that any final agreement must protect the rights and interests of the Iranian nation and guarantee the sustainable removal of the sanctions imposed on the country. Robert Carter sent us this report from Vienna.
The Iranian negotiating team left the Austrian capital Vienna Tuesday morning following the European Union's latest bid to salvage the 2015 deal. Tehran will now discuss proposals after assessing the text submitted by the European Union. The latest round of the Vienna talks involved Iran, Russia, China, Germany, France and Britain and lasted for 4 days. The US, meanwhile, remained sidelined due to its unilateral withdrawal from the accord in 2018. Press TV managed to speak with a senior advisor of the Iranian delegation, who acknowledged progress in the talks, but added that Tehran remains distrustful and maintains a cautious approach.
The Iranians will analyze the text very carefully. We have a very bad experience with the United States and the Europeans. The Americans under Obama violated the deal. Under Trump, they tore up the deal. And under Biden, they continued with Trump's policies. And the EU followed the Americans, regardless of whether they were happy about events or not. So for us, it's a very carefully constructed text that needs to be accepted by all sides so that the Americans don't have the opportunity to use any loopholes to harm ordinary Iranians again.
Speaking to journalists, Russia's envoy appeared confident following the talks.
The aim of negotiations is to restore full implementation of what we achieved in 2015, to restore the nuclear deal and to lift anti-Iranian sanctions. It's feasible.
Despite the positive ambience surrounding the Vienna talks, Western media reporting of the negotiations has been censured by Iran. Tehran's negotiating team has dismissed as false suggestions by Western media that remaining issues have been resolved.
Iran says that it is determined to get a deal which upholds its rights but also guarantees an enduring and effective removal of sanctions. The thing is, though, that when Joe Biden is eventually booted out of the White House, if a deal is agreed here in Vienna, could the next US president pull another Trump stunt? Well, with Europe's economy facing continued hardships over the war in Ukraine, Western countries may find that they are in greater need of a final resolution here than Iran is. Robert Carter, Vienna.
Russia says the elimination of terrorists in Syria hinges on the complete withdrawal of U.S. forces from the Arab country. Russia's envoy to the U.N., Vasily Nebenzia, made the remarks while addressing a Security Council meeting. He noted that remaining terrorists in Syria are currently sheltered in areas not controlled by the government. Nebenzia underlined that the departure of U.S. troops will eliminate terrorists not only in Syria but its neighboring countries as well. The Russian diplomat said Moscow has neutralized a group of terrorists in recent strikes near America's Al-Tanf base in southern Syria. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
America is reeling in shock this week after former President Donald Trump's Florida residence, Mar-a-Lago, was raided by the FBI. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Tom Norton. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Donald Trump and the Mar-a-Lago FBI Raid. What we do know, what we don't. America is reading in shock this week after former President Donald Trump's Florida residence, Mar-a-Lago, was raided by the FBI. It is understood to be part of an ongoing investigation into the potentially unlawful removal and destruction of classified White House records after Donald Trump left office in January of 2021. In a statement made via his Truth Social app, Donald Trump claimed the property was under siege and that the raid was unannounced, with many of his supporters arriving at the property to protest the move. While there may be very strong grounds for the investigation, little to no formal information has been shared by the Department of Justice or by the FBI, with social media abuzz with conjecture. Claims range from deep state conspiracy theories to the possibility that Donald Trump may no longer be able to run for office in 2024. To help filter the noise, Newsweek has examined the speculation and analysis to try to accurately determine what, at this stage, can be confidently reported. And here is what we do know. As mentioned, Donald Trump announced on Monday, 8th of August, that his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida was under siege, raided and occupied by federal agents taking part in an unannounced raid. It follows months of speculation that federal prosecutors were examining his actions regarding the riots at the U.S. Capitol on 6th of January 2021, as well as in other cases. Speaking to Fox News Channel, Donald Trump's son, Eric Trump, said, "The purpose of the raid, from what they said, was because the National Archives wanted to corroborate whether or not Donald Trump had any documents in his possession. This follows the retrieval of 15 boxes of documents from Mar-a-Lago in January, which was reported by the Washington Post, to include letters sent between Donald Trump and North Korean President Kim Jong-un, documents marked as classified and others labeled top secret. The National Archives and Records Administration was said to have assisted in retrieving the boxes, but denied its involvement. Most of the details about law enforcement's Monday visit to Mar-a-Lago are still not public, with the Department of Justice and the FBI yet to comment on the investigation. To sift through some of the possibilities, Newsweek spoke to two former federal prosecutors. Michael Stern, who worked for 25 years for the Department of Justice, and Gene Rossi, who, along with almost 30 years of experience, has worked alongside John Rowley, who is now representing Donald Trump in talks with the Department of Justice. The most pertinent question still outstanding is on what grounds the FBI conducted the raid on Mar-a-Lago State in Palm Beach, Florida, late on Monday, 8th of August. As we've said, both the Department of Justice and the FBI remain tight-lipped on the specifics. According to Michael Stern and Gene Rossi, however, the authorities would not have moved on Mar-a-Lago without substantive grounds for doing so. In order for a search warrant to be signed by a judge, the judge must have determined that Trump's house would more likely than not contain evidence of a crime. That's called the probable cause standard. You can also say would probably contain evidence of a crime, Michael Stern said. Gene Rossi in turn said that the prosecutors must have a tremendous amount of probable cause that someone, likely Donald Trump, has committed a federal crime or several crimes. And I don't buy the argument that the affidavit only talks about classified documents. I'm sure that affidavit includes a lot more than just classified documents. I can't help but believe that there are other crimes listed under search warrant, Gene Rossi added. The Trump family has also said the attorneys were not allowed to visit the property during the search, a claim that Newsweek was not able to independently verify. Gene Rossi told Newsweek that a lawyer's presence would be a privilege, but not a right, and that attorneys would be very limited by what they could do during the course of a search. 99% of search warrants are conducted without any lawyers present, he said. And when he or she is present at the search warrant, all they can do is sit on a couch and watch. They can't interfere with the search. They can't comment. They can't direct. They can't obstruct. But if they do any of those things, they'll be arrested. According to Gene Rossi, there's also the possibility that during the course of their search, that other material, which could lead to charges, may be taken as part of the FBI's investigation. Once you are on the property legitimately, and when you're executing a search warrant approved by a federal judge, you have the authority to be there legitimately, he said. If they see evidence in plain view that may be contraband or evidence of other crimes, then they can seize that item also. As mentioned, Donald Trump claimed the search was unannounced. However, Trump has been in conversation with investigators since the start of the year and cooperated in part. Both Gene Rossi and Michael Stern told Newsweek their belief that cooperation was probably not as forthcoming as described. Gene Rossi said, "I can't stress enough that they did the search warrant because they really weren't cooperating to the satisfaction of the FBI and the Department of Justice. It was all window dressing. It was all verbiage. It wasn't sincere in their mind. So that's why they executed the search warrant," they said. They said, "Enough is enough," and they took the drastic step. It is a drastic step of getting a search warrant. You know, Mark Meadows has been doing this, Peter Navarro, Steve Bannon, and they're all doing this. They're dragging their feet. They're saying they're cooperating, but they're really not cooperating. So the FBI just said, "Forget about it, we're going to get a search warrant." Michael Stern echoed those points. Michael Stern said, "If there was a new search warrant for documents, it means that Donald Trump's cooperation was not being offered in good faith. It means he still had documents that he refused to return despite knowing he was required to do so. A search warrant is the perfect tool to get the documents back under those circumstances." All the Republican discussion about the FBI previously taking materials back that Donald Trump had removed from the White House as being enough is wrong. The fact that a search warrant was issued and documents were seized means Donald Trump did not give them everything he had improperly taken. Some commentators have also noted how the investigation has coincided with the Alex Jones defamation trial and the revelations that Alex Jones's phone messages have reportedly been subpoenaed by the January 6th committee investigating the attack on the US Capitol. On Wednesday, 3rd of August, defense lawyer Mark Bankston, representing families of children killed in Sandy Hook, told Alex Jones in court that he was sent the InfoWars founder's phone messages for the past 2 years. Newsweek Fact Check has reported on a list of people with some connections to Alex Jones that this case could implicate, including Donald Trump himself, with whom Alex Jones remained in contact during the former president's term in office, and through intermediaries around the time of the Capitol attack on 6th of January 2021. However, the two events don't appear to be linked. We still don't have official confirmation that the January 6th committee has indeed subpoenaed the messages although some outlets have reported it has, which of those it does and does not have access to, and if any of the documents may implicate Donald Trump. We also don't know whether the documents taken from Mar-a-Lago definitely are related to 6th of January 2021, and it seems unlikely that the FBI raid was prompted by the Alex Jones revelations. There's further speculation the raid could affect Donald Trump's chances of running for office, with some pointing to U.S. legal codes on concealment, removal, or mutilation generally of presidential records protected under the Presidential Records Act. Gene Rossi told Newsweek that one of the possible penalties for presidential record violations under the statutes is that you cannot hold federal office ever again. Rossi added, if he's indicted for something other than the Presidential Records Act, if he's indicted for insurrection and sedition and convicted of that, he can't hold office again. If he's convicted of, say, taxes or wire fraud, then he could run for office again. There's also the question about the timing of the investigation and the timing of the raid, with some claiming it is linked to a Department of Justice custom of not launching politically sensitive investigations less than 90 days before an election, such as this November's midterm elections. The fallout of the FBI search into Hillary Clinton's computer was considered by some to have severely damaged any chance that the former Secretary of State had at becoming president in 2016. The risk of repeating the same decision and the repercussions it might entail may well have loomed in the minds of FBI investigators. Michael Stern told Newsweek it wasn't clear why the 90-day custom would apply, given that Donald Trump is not officially a candidate, at least not formally. That said, federal law enforcement will undoubtedly make an effort to avoid even the appearance of political motivation in actions like this, and so they have stayed outside the 90 days limit, Stern added. It is important to note that it is a protocol used by federal law enforcement, and it is not a law. There may be times when a law enforcement action is so imperative that it is done within 90 days of an election. Michael Stern added, remember, the FBI conducted a search on a computer connected to Hillary Clinton and made a statement about it 11 days before a presidential election in which she was the Democratic nominee. Despite the FBI's apparent adherence to protocol, there are calls among some conservatives in the wake of the raid for the FBI to be dissolved and an investigation to be launched. It is worth noting that Donald Trump has a well-documented and complicated history with the FBI, with his dismissal of then-FBI Director, Director General James Comey, who oversaw the Clinton email probe, being perhaps the most publicized and controversial encounter. While some conservative commentators believe the raid on Mar-a-Lago is connected to a deep state operation engineered to overthrow right-leaning politicians, the fact remains that current FBI Director Christopher Wray was appointed by Donald Trump himself. But Christopher Wray has admittedly has attacked Donald Trump since then.
Lebanon's Hezbollah chief has stressed that resistance is the only option for Palestinian people in their present circumstances. He reminded the fact that Hezbollah stands at the forefront of the battle against the Quds occupied regime. On the home front, the Hezbollah chief has stressed the resistance movement will not allow Israel to even imagine plundering the Lebanese natural resources. Now, the warning is made amid a maritime dispute over the Karish gas field in the Mediterranean that Tel Aviv is trying to exploit. Welcome to The Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let's see who's joining us in this episode of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier in Marseille, France. Also with us is manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, in Toronto, Canada. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, Elijah, the Hezbollah leader has allotted the Palestinian resistance fighters in the besieged Gaza Strip for their resilience and steadfastness, emphasizing that they have managed to impose their demands on the Tel Aviv regime, referring to the truce achieved recently between Islamic Jihad and Israel. Your thoughts on that, please.
Thank you for having me.
Sure.
First of all, the Israeli Prime Minister, they intended to show that he couldn't bear the insult that his predecessor, Benjamin Netanyahu, suffered from the sword of Jerusalem last year when heavy losses have been inflicted on Israel during the last battle. So what happened in the last 3 days is a battle between Israel that considers itself the strongest army in the Middle East and one of the most powerful army in the world that is fighting a very small organization like the Palestinian Islamic Jihad that find himself alone in the battle against Israel and manage for 3 days to bomb and to launch more than 330 missiles and rockets every single day, when during the Sword of Jerusalem last year, all the group, Palestinian groups, launched 350 rockets and missiles per day. Now, when we see the Israelis running under the skirt of Egypt, Qatar, and the United Nations, asking for the cessation of hostility and for a ceasefire, it is shown that Israelis were in deep need to stop this escalation, because it was not ready for it, and it will never be ready for it, because its domestic front is very fragile. Now, what the Palestinians managed is to bomb 58 settlements, and all the people were forced, for the first time, all the Israelis were forced to be evacuated by the Israeli army and taken to other more secure location, and the Palestinian Jihad presented its demand and imposed its demand on the Israelis. And we have seen how the Egyptians announced first that the ceasefire is going to be announced at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, but the Islamic Jihad insisted on its demand, and Israel met this demand at 11:30 in the evening. So it shows how the Palestinian organization, the Palestinian Islamic organization, managed to impose its conditions on Israel and managed to impose the ceasefire according to its condition, not when the Israelis wanted. Mm-hmm. This is a very great achievement for one single group that earned more support by all the society that is hosting it inside Gaza, and a lot of respect by all the other Palestinian organizations, showing that this is the only way to fight Israel.
Right. And the interesting thing is that Islamic Jihad is not a very big resistant movement. Now, Firas, let's now focus on another fact, and that is Israel's vulnerability, and as Elijah put it, fragility. As time passes by, we see more of this. And we've got proof of this, you know, especially in the past decade, during which wars were fought and Tel Aviv faced defeat.
Yes.
Relating to the 2021 battle of Jerusalem, the Sword of Jerusalem, we've seen that the Zionist regime was very weak, and they were being, hit by the rockets of the resistance heavily. Different cities were getting hit, and the Israelis would make all types of threats, but then they wouldn't even implement any of the threats. And we see the same thing with them threatening, for instance, the Islamic Republic of Iran. How much times has presidents and prime ministers of the Zionist regime have threatened Iran, for all these years, but never did nothing about it? If you're such a mighty army, and if you're so strong, and you have such sophisticated weapons, and you have such strong lobbies, and you have such strong Western military support, by the U.S., U.K., France, and all these different regimes, so then why not go on with your plan? Why go and cry in the United Nations and make up fabricated lies that Iran has, for instance, nuclear weapons, or the Palestinians are being supplied with all types of weapons, and this is a danger to the Israeli citizens and so on? It shows very weak points. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, in recent speeches, he said that Israel is standing on one foot. So they know that Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is a very credible man when he speaks. He does not lie. We've seen that in the 2006 war, August war between the Zionist regime and the Lebanese nation and Hezbollah, the resistance, that they weren't able to get any of the conditions that they wanted to have completed, you know what I mean? And they infully pulled out, and they infully released all the prisoners of Hezbollah in the exchange that was done mediated through Germany. So Israel's in a very weak position right now. And we've seen that they only fought, like you said a little while ago, that it's a small group. You know, Islamic Jihad is not a very big group. It doesn't have so many fighters, compared to Hamas, for instance. And they were targeting mostly this group, especially in Muharram. And they know that they're very tied to Iran and very close to Iran. And some of their members are also Shia Muslims that are Palestinian. So I think this was actually a deliberate attack as well on the followers of Imam Hussein at this time, by attacking in Muharram, the Gaza Strip, and hitting Islamic Jihad, while the leader of Islamic Jihad, Nakhala, was in Iran sitting down with the president of Iran. So it's very significant. I think they were really targeting for an agenda. It wasn't just something without any understanding, or just an awkward attack. No, this was an attack. There was a precise plan to this, an agenda.
Right. Now, Elijah, Nasrallah and many others argue that given the goings-on, like the so-called normalization deals and the West's inaction as regards Tel Aviv's atrocities and violations, Palestinians need to boost deterrence, and that the resistance is the only way ahead of them. Do you agree with that?
I fully agree with that for one simple reason. The Palestinians can no longer rely on the Madrid summit or the Oslo agreement or any other Gulf country that normalized relationship with Israel. So that is over. The only lesson that the Palestinians came out with after 70 years of struggle is that the armed struggle is the only way to get their right and recover their land. And what the Palestinian Islamic Jihad did in the last 3 days is to impose deterrence on the Israelis. Otherwise, the Israelis would have killed one leader after another, not only in the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but also Hamas and all the other groups. So this is the only language that the Israelis understand. And we have seen how Hezbollah in Lebanon and in Syria managed to impose deterrence on the Israelis. And the Israelis are pulling back on targeting any Hezbollah individual or leader. For that, the Palestinians have learned the lesson. And the lesson is you have to become strong, and you have to respond to any of the Israelis' aggression, even with your limited capabilities, because we have to understand that Gaza has been surrounded since its existence. And the two crossings depend on the Israeli mood and the Egyptians that respond to the Israeli desire and decision. Therefore, the limited support that Gaza is getting, it's managing to stand against one of the most powerful army, the Israelis, but imposing deterrence by responding for three consecutive days and during the Sword of Jerusalem last year for 11 days. This is how it is important to impose deterrence, but not relying on other countries, particularly the Arab countries, who signed deals with Israel.
Right. Now, Firas, let's take a glance at the role of the United States here. You know, the so-called Abraham Accord that they pushed and encouraged some Arab states to sign those normalization deals with Tel Aviv regime. It's just further emboldened the Tel Aviv regime to perpetuate aggression against Palestinians, as you see, and get away with his crimes. Your take, please.
Yes, I mean, the Zionist regime relies on illegitimate regimes, and this is how they feel they're empowered, or they, you know, they're world mafia. You know, they're a bunch of mercenaries and criminals, and they've were able to put a system together and somehow get support. Mm. And they're when they reach out to tribal regimes, these tyrannical tribal treacherous regimes such as the Al Saud, the Saudi regime, or Al Nahyan, the Emirati regime, or Al Khalifa, the Bahrain regime. I mean, these regimes, they don't respect their own citizens, they don't respect human rights, they don't respect international law, they don't respect even democracy. They don't have anybody that's elected in their system. They're just inherited through tribal systems, you know what I mean? These systems are obviously gonna somehow incline with the Israeli regime, because they're both interconnected by supporting oppression, and both are people that love power and control, and love just to enjoy life. And based on obviously they're enjoying life on the benefits and the interest of human beings and their own nations as well. So they kind of obviously give them a little bit of empowerment that they can say now on TV and on the screens that we have other Arabic or Muslim countries that are with us, and they're supporting us, and they're becoming allies with us, and they use us all the time. But then when we look at the real picture and who these regimes are, we know that these regimes are all have no credibility, have no respect for anything, and they're crumbling themselves. Their own nations do not trust them, they don't believe in them, and they're supporting illegal wars. Look what they're doing in Yemen. All those countries that we're talking about now that are supporting normalization were all involved in the coalition at a certain point. You know, even the Morocco is involved in certain point. So they're all involved also in killing their own neighborly countries and own Muslim countries and more. You know, they're UK installed regimes also, if you look at the history of them and the base. And Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah made it clear in his speech that Bahrain it suppresses its own people in Ashura when people are trying to join their ceremonies and their processions for Imam al-Hussein and to commemorate this great figure that fought against injustice, that they will the Bahraini regime is suppressing them, but they're letting the Zionists come and tour Bahrain, you know, foreigners. They respect the foreigners more than their own citizens. So it's very clear who's on which side and what side is the good and what side is the bad. Mm-hmm. And the Israeli regime is the weak side, and they're I just wanted to kind of shape the other person on the other side there that was speaking. He said it's a very powerful army, Israeli. It's not the powerful army. They have powerful weapons. They have they have a militarized system. They have support, but really they're weak. We've seen them in 2006 in the battle. We've seen them in Gaza in 2021. We've seen them in many battles, and we see them also in Jerusalem. They cannot even face off with the senior citizens, the old ladies there that expose the Zionist IDF soldiers and Israeli police and humiliate them, you know. And even the young people of Jerusalem and the West Bank, you know. And what did we get from normalization? What did we get from peace treaties? Look at Mahmoud Abbas. What treatment and respect do they have for him? They walk into the West Bank every day, violate the people's homes, arrest who they want, shoot what they want. What did we get from negotiations? Nothing. The resistance is the only way forward, and it must be strengthened, empowered, especially in the West Bank. As Sayyid Khamenei said, that the West Bank needs to be armed and needs to be able to battle and support their other brothers in different cities in Palestine.
Okay, yeah, that's the key question, Elijah. What did they get from this? I mean, I'm talking about those Arab states who signed these normalization deals with Israel. What did they achieve apart from the fury of the Palestinians who feel betrayed?
The Arab states thought that approaching Israel means also approaching America even further. and have the support of Israel in the region was also a favor that the Arabs did to the Americans when they had no problem in selling the Palestinian cause and didn't mean anything anymore to them. Now, it turned out that America is no longer ruling the world. Its unilateralism is in question. Russia is challenging it. China is also challenging it. And two-thirds of the world is not with the West. I mean, the Americans and the Europeans. So all this relationship with Israel is to say we don't want war with the Israelis. They have never been at war with the Israelis. And they, above all, give up on the Palestinian cause when we see the Palestinians holding on to their cause and they want their land generation after generation. And mainly what we see in Palestine is a very young generation. So the behavior of the Arab leaders, not population, because not all population agree with the move of their leaders. We've seen that in Egypt, we've seen that in Jordan, where both countries maintain since decades good relationship with Israel. And we see that in the in Saudi Arabia and the Emirates and in Qatar, when the Israelis killed the other day the Qatari journalists that work for Al Jazeera. So we saw also the aggression that Qatar is having toward Israel. So all that, even if it is all kind of a show, at the end of the day, the Arabs never supported the Palestinians. On the contrary, in the war in 2006 against Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Saudis were the first supporter of this war. In previous war, the Saudis and the Emiratis, they were offering intelligence information to the Israelis. So this kind of support has been going on for decades under the table, and now it's coming out to the public.
Right. Now, for us, let's talk about the Lebanon and issues related to that. Nasrallah said that the resistance movement is stronger than ever, and he says Israelis should not test the Lebanese resolve to protect their natural resources. That's a folly. Let's talk a bit about Hezbollah's growing military might.
Yes. I mean, they thought they got them in a trap when they went into Syria, but truly they gained a lot of experience there, and they fought a lot of different terrorist groups that were funded and supported and armed by the West and by the Zionist regime and by the Saudis and all these people. But all these groups came and all these mercenaries infiltrated inside Syria, but Hezbollah was able to defeat them and fight against them. So they really gained a lot of military strength. And also, don't forget, the war, you know, the Daesh war, when the ISIS controlled a lot of Iraq as well, Hezbollah was involved in supporting the Iraqis. And, you know, they're also... their integration and, you know, their work alongside Qasem Soleimani and the Iranian generals, you know, everybody's supporting everybody and everybody's helping each other and they're learning from each other's experiences. So Hezbollah in 2006 also earned a lot of experience and learned a lot of, you know, ins and outs and, you know, weaknesses and strengths. And now they are preparing for a very decisive and strong battle coming up. Hezbollah now is ready because, as you can see, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah is saying that the Karish gas field is not going to be stolen by the Israelis. Right. We will maintain and we will, you know, we will liberate our areas. We will secure our sovereignty. We will secure our resources. And going forward, that we will not let anybody breach the laws or take our rights away. And Hezbollah is a credible organization. An incredible political party that's you know, democratically elected and respected. You know, they're very integrated also inside the system. They have one of the biggest allies with them, the Patriotic Party, Lebanese Christian Party inside Lebanon. I mean, they're ready for a very strong battle, and the Zionist regime isn't ready for this battle. And if they think they are, they're very foolish. That's for sure.
Mm-hmm. And Elijah, Tel Aviv is going to exploit this gas bill, which is under dispute. Is this not a violation of international law? I mean, shouldn't the sides first try and, you know, set a negotiating table and address the differences and points in dispute and clarify, you know, maritime borders and do the demarcation and all that, and then do any exploitation of anything?
Well, I don't recall when Israel respects any international laws, exactly like the Americans never respect international laws. Because international laws exist only when they are used by the West, but not when they are and their allies, but not when they should be applied to every single nation around the world. So starting to explore the gas and oil in Karish or in other places, first of all, this is a Palestinian territory. It's a Palestinian sea. It's Palestinian land. Secondly, the Israelis don't really care about what to take and who this belongs to as long as they want it. So this is where it goes back to your previous question, imposing deterrence. Only when Hezbollah managed to impose deterrence on Israel that the Hezbollah menace against the Israelis, if they start exploiting the gas and oil, they will get a war. This is the only language that Israel understands, not the international law that are violated every single day. Surrounding Gaza is a violation of the international law. Preventing oil, fuel and food and medical supply to Gaza is a violation of international law, as said by the United Nations rapporteur on Gaza. So all these are behaviors and attitude of Israel that is very well known. Assassination of leaders, assassination of Palestinians or Iranian or Lebanese or Syrian or Iraqi, these are violations of international laws. There is nothing new in that because Israel doesn't care about the international law.
Okay. Now, on that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier in Marseille and manager of the Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, in Toronto.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
السلام عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
وإنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein عليه السلام in dialogue.
صلى الله عليك يا أبا عبد الله.
Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the esteemed Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali alayhi salam, the grandson of the esteemed and honorable Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards salvation and prosperity, the one who addresses Allah on the day of Ashura, saying, in so many